Blog Talk Radio.
I can hear the song worth singing. I can too sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing. I got you. Sing it.
Welcome, welcome to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And today's date is October the 2nd, 2019. My, oh my, how this year has, as we say, time has wings. Well, those of you who join us on a regular basis, you know, welcome to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm your host, Ronald Buffet. And you know, this show is brought to you every week by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC. And you know the slogan for this show. If it's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative is a blueprint for economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African Americans solar installation companies to address the economic impacts of higher energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, to utilize Black-owned farmlands, HBCU campuses, to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the unemployment and unemployment of young African Americans locally and nationally. Also to educate the Black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change that disproportionately affects communities of color. In other words, our neighborhoods. And the need for more environmental education in the Black community through Black Talk Radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And it's also brought to you by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSHBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative. And you can get more information on that initiative by logging on to our website at positivechangepc.com. At positivechangepc.com. It's also brought to you by Scotton Communications Network, specializing in the following areas: public relations, writing, editing, web development, web editing, magazine production online and traditional, newspaper production online and traditional, speech writing, book writing, editing and publishing, and speaker bureau management. And for further information, you can contact ScottonCommunicationsNetwork.com. That's S-C-O-T-T-O-N, communications with an S, network.com. That's a mouthful, ladies and gentlemen. But anyway, as I said as we begin our show, if you want to join us, and I didn't say, but if you want to join us, you can dial us at 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Now, we have a very, very, very exciting show for you today, and we have the privilege of having a guest at the very, very top of this segment of our show, and I have him in our green room, and I'm going to bring this gentleman right on into our platform, on this platform, Mr. Larry Sally, who is the chair, interim chairman at Benedict for the Historically Black Colleges and Universities Community Development Coalition. And they recently have received the grant for $250,000 for the HBCU Lead Clean Energy Initiative. And as we can always say, without further ado, good morning to you, Mr. Sally.
Well, good morning. Good morning. Good morning to you and all of your listeners.
Well, thank you for joining us here on Solar Now and the Future with its Economic Impact on Black America. As you heard me in my introduction, one of our primary focuses is to look at what's going on at our historically black colleges and universities in this renewable energy sector. And as you know as well as I know, being in the area of economic development at one of our historic HBCUs, the Great Benedict College there in Columbia, South Carolina, in my home state. I hail from Dillon, South Carolina, so I'm a proud South Carolina native, even though I ended up playing football at Morgan State College back in the day for legendary Errol Banks, and as we can say, everything is history. But I'm very, very pleased, sir, to have you take time from your very, very busy schedule to come on and sort of educate our listening audience to the HBCU Community Development Group and this initiative that y'all launched with the Department of Energy. I think it was several years back that y'all signed a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Energy, and I see that the number of institutions that were a part of that original group has grown. So growth is always good. So could you please share some information about your role at Benedict and your background and what brought you into this arena?
Well, sure. Thank you, Mr. Bethea. I appreciate that. Appreciate you for having us. I serve as the executive director of the Benedict Allen Community Development Corporation and the director of Benedict College's Business Development Center. Of course, Benedict College is a historically black college located in Columbia, South Carolina. My background is, of course, business development, social work, grants writing, economic development. I've worked for the college here now for 22 years. Back in 2009-2010, several HBCUs came together that worked in the area of community economic development and decided to form an organization called the HBCU Community Development Action Coalition, or CDAC. And what we were thinking about is being able to generate some partnerships and some energy around the communities that the HBCUs serve, looking at joint programming, training, and a number of initiatives to try to help redevelop and revitalize those communities and those campuses, and thus came the organization itself. I've been the chair of the board for the organization now probably about 3 years now. And in 2017, we signed an agreement with the U.S. Department of Energy with the then secretary just before the new administration came in to develop programming and initiatives through the Department of Energy to advance renewable energy programming, education, and technology. And out of that, we approached an organization called the JPB Foundation and asked them if they would fund a startup grant for us to help us do some demonstration projects in several communities on HBCU campuses. And that's where our solar initiative came in. Since that time, we've had 14 HBCU campuses. Morgan State is one of those, Benedict College, of course, St. Augustine, and several others. other campuses around the country that have gotten involved with various demonstration projects to advance the area of solar energy in our community. And it's important to us because, of course, most of our communities are challenged financially. They're also challenged based on the quality of life in those areas. And we feel that the HBCUs can not only be a leader in those efforts, but they can help develop some of the answers in cooperation with those communities. But that's how the initiative got started, and we have completed that particular program. We just recently completed it, submitted our final report, and we're now looking to get a larger initiative going with JPB and the Department of Energy. But that's essentially a capsule of where we are.
Well, Mr. Sally, I greatly appreciate what the coalition has done because I sort of got started in this arena looking at Dr. Thompson, the former provost at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. I went down in 2015 and I visited the dean of the School of Engineering, Dr. Dunn, because we were looking at workforce development opportunities, and I knew that I was aware that UMES had built the first what we would call solar farm or power plant on HBCU campus, which was a 17-acre farm. Little did I know, in looking at what had happened from Dr. Thompson's vision, at the same time in 2011 that she was in fact getting that solar farm constructed, the Department of NASA was carteling a lot of their commercial launches from Cape Canaveral, and they relocated that launch facility on the eastern shore near Aikiki Island. And what happened was when I went down with an associate of mine and speaking with Dr. Dunn at that time, he took me into his office and he linked up to the satellite. And he, when it beamed down, he showed us 100,000 acres of solar farms surrounding UMES's campus. Even though UMES sets on 800 acres, and their farm was only 17 acres, but it served as a model. And that model became a major thrust for providing energy that these farmers have done lease contracts with major developers and built 100,000 acres of commercial solar farms on the eastern shore. They are selling that energy back to NASA as a one of the major energy thrusts with battery systems to do commercial launches. So when I looked at the impetus and the importance of the fact that after salaries at any college or university, and I know you can verify this, your number two cost at a college or university is energy, isn't it?
It certainly is. It certainly is. That's a huge cost to operate the institutions, to maintain them. We've looked at that as an organization. At one point, we were exploring the possibility of developing our own power grids on some of the campuses, and that technology does exist. There's a the University of Chicago there has a model that we were looking at. One of the things that we thought about was how can we best address that on the college campuses, and solar, of course, is a very, very affordable solution.
I don't want to stop you here in the middle of your thought pattern, but this is something why I have to stop you, because our community needs to learn how to connect the dots between their vote that elects our politicians, that make public policy, that affect our communities and our institutions. And what I'm speaking to is when we began to look at where our HBCUs are physically located in the deeper South, Southwest states, these are all regulated states. And what I'm and this is something that this is why I started this show. I found out there's absolutely no education in the black community talking about energy, talking about regulated versus deregulated versus suspended regulation. And I want to sort of touch on that because I find that most of our HBCUs are in regulated states, meaning to our listening audience that you have one major utility provider, which is Duke Energy for South Carolina and North Carolina, which is the sole monopoly on being able to generate that energy, produce that energy, and sell that energy to the end user. Where you look at University of Maryland, Eastern Shore, we only have three solar farms. You could correct me on this. I stand for your correction. But as I look at it, we only have three solar farms presently on our HBCU campus, the University of Virgin Islands, which that got hit by the storm, and we have University of Maryland and Eastern Shore and Bowie State University just cut the ribbon on a 7-acre farm, which I have the head of their facility plant on this platform talking about the historic piece that took place at Bowie by them opening up this 7-acre solar farm. And when we begin to look at this regulation, how our schools are being denied billions of dollars and federal grant opportunities coming out of EPA and DOE and agriculture, because a lot of times in the regulated states, they're just not able to participate in a lot of things because of regulation, because of the stranglehold of the gas and oil lobby over these southern states. Am I wrong, or could you speak to that?
Well, that's certainly true, Mr. Bethay. There is one additional campus that if I'm not mistaken, does have a solar farm, and that's Prairie View A&M.
Prairie View, okay.
Uh huh.
Okay, great.
In terms of the process, you're correct. It's difficult to get into the industry. The large utility companies, Duke Energy here in South Carolina, now Dominion, who took over for South Carolina Electric and Gas, which also is probably the second largest power provider here in South Carolina. They have a stranglehold, as you said, on the legislature, on the process. They have a bill here in South Carolina called net metering. We were there last year as an institution talking to the legislature, trying to convince them to increase the, for lack of a better word, the reimbursement rate for selling power back to the grid. It's not financially advantageous for independent smaller providers to even sell it back. I mean, you know, you're getting 1 cent per kilowatt hour, that kind of thing, 2 cents at the most, which is difficult because there are a lot of outlay of costs that go into it. But the benefit to the HBCUs is, of course, they have, in a lot of cases, large land holdings in and around their campuses that could be converted there. They have technology programs, computer science, engineering, environmental science programs that could harness the student power, the faculty brain trust to develop solar farms in those areas, put that power back on the grid, and make those campuses more independent. That's one of the focuses that we had for our grant, and that's something that we're looking at going forward for the next proposal, is to try to make those campuses more independent. But policy development, education is something that we have got to have really got to work on when it comes to that. So that's a challenge.
Well, I know, Mr. Sally, it's a challenge because I have looked at this issue. I've been to conference after conference. I've gone to public policy forums, and sometimes I look like a spotter pepper in a salt box, but, you know, I'm in there anyway because we've got to know what is moving. And what I want our listening audience to understand is that our institutions, our churches, and our colleges and universities, love them, like them, have your own opinion. But that's all we got. And we got to fight like hell to make sure if there's any way that we can advocate on behalf of the HBCUs and our church institutions, because many of our schools are private church institutions, and some of them are state-supported. And I know that the policies around these things get a little different. But Mr. Sally, looking at the agenda, I have the privilege of having the roundtable agenda in front of me that was discussed last year at Morgan State University, which was put on by a very, very dynamic young lady, Ms. Natasha Campbell, which is your, I think she's your strategy director for your group. And she brought together at Morgan the a community development action coalition. Y'all came together with entities from the Department of Energy. You had people there from the Department of Agriculture there. And we talked about the different programs. But one of the issues that is becoming, which is very, very disturbing to me, is when solar energy is not new. We both know that. It's been around since the space program. And until President Obama came to power, after the very, very embarrassing situation that took place when our community in New Orleans, the South, Ninth Ward in New Orleans, was hit by Katrina in 2007, Van Jones was able to get then President Bush to administration and Congress to ratify the Green Jobs Act. And from that ratification, you know, most is for our listening audience, well, the industry really can't grow until Congress codifies that industry. If I understand that to be correct, you can correct me, Mr. Sally, because you're probably more educated on this issue than I am. But what affected me, I looked at, was the overwhelming political capital that we invested in getting President Obama elected twice. And I mean, we had some folks didn't look like us who voted for him too, and they didn't vote for him just because he looked like me and you. They voted for him because they thought he was the best candidate. But the issue of public policy is most people have been beat down to think that the Affordable Care Act was the most important thing that President Obama's administration did. It was not. It was called the Sunshine Identity Initiative through the Department of Energy. He put $31 billion in federal loan guarantees to jumpstart this renewable energy industry. But when we look at the number of engineers, professionals that our HBCUs are turning out every year, train people, and you look at the renewable energy industry, I've had to beg Abigail Harper from the Solar Industry Trade Association to tell me why there's not more diversity in this renewable energy, especially wind and solar. Could you speak to that issue?
Well, that's certainly true. That was a very, very important piece of legislation that or initiative that came out of the Obama administration, and it empowered local communities to be able to identify renewable sources of energy that worked in their community, to provide education, and to put demonstration funds or project development funds in those communities. Unfortunately, it's been watered down by local legislators and the like,
But it is the framework is still in place. A lot of the folks that joined the Obama administration during that time are still in place at the Department of Energy. Of course, the new administration has moved on to more development of fossil fuels, those kinds of less than environmentally friendly kinds of energies. But that is a problem. But we have embraced the SunShot initiative. That's one of the centerpieces of our programming at this point, and we're trying to address that through the local campuses. Matter of fact, we had a summit earlier this year, I believe it was February of this year, in Miami, and we really discussed that. We had experts from a number of agencies, probably 18 HBCU campuses came down, and we really were able to look at suggestions on how we can do that and how we can address that through some of the other programming, which I saw some very promising pieces. But trying to get initiative and keep that initiative going is a real challenge.
Well, look, Sally, my organization, the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, that's what we are. We are a cooperative. We were set up with sole purpose of trying to increase market share for our African-American solar installation development companies. Now, I don't know if you're aware of the numbers, but according to the Solar Foundation that gets our tax dollars to keep up with statistical data on employment and who's doing what in this renewable energy industry, specifically solar, we only have 35 African-American solar installation design and development company and installation companies doing business in the U.S. And my organization works, we are connected and have been in contact with all of them, trying to get them to understand that we need to form a collaboration to work with organizations such as your organization to do public-private partnerships, because our organizations are, these companies are, these developers, they are the ones that can also bring in the private investment capital, because there are billions of dollars coming into this renewable energy sector through the green infrastructure financing mechanism, which Congress has already put in place, called the Property Clean Energy Assistance Program, known as PACE. Are you familiar with that program, Mr. Salen?
I am.
Could you speak on the impact of what that could do? Because most of our HBCUs, if I'm not mistaken, and I could stand corrected on this, but most of our HBCUs are already located in what they call enterprise zones, so this would be an excellent way to help bring in more investment opportunities for the renovation of property and clean infrastructure around our communities where our HBCUs are located. Because let's face it, we have the issue of gentrification going on in all of our major cities. And where we are strategically located, when there has been statistical studies shown that the average young person that goes into college and gets a degree end up settling within 100-mile radius of where they graduate from colleges and universities. And traditionally, our students from our HBCUs have had to move toward the Atlantas, the New Yorks, the Washingtons, the Philadelphias, the Memphises, toward those urban markets where there are job opportunities. So there are a billion opportunities tied up in this renewable energy industry, looking at electric vehicle infrastructure line, where you need electricians that could be trained through workforce development training programs, and getting to that point, when Obama's administration came to power in 2008, the Green Jobs Act resulted in $500 million of workforce development training. So being that you've been in this economic development arena, what happened to that funding, Mr. Sally? Why didn't more of that money get targeted to our HBCUs? Y'all the lifeline.
Well, I agree, and it's something that we've discussed. Matter of fact, we tried to discuss it from a national level through the HBCU initiative, which is a part of the White House initiative every year that they held before the Congressional Black Caucus Summit every year. One of the issues that's happened is, of course, there's not a lot of faith from the larger agencies, Energy and some of the others, that the HBCUs can pull it off. Plus, the strategy is lacking. HBCUs in the communities that we reside in are anchors. They're usually the largest neighbor. They're usually the neighbor with the most resources, and they're probably the oldest neighbor in those communities. Our campus here is next year will celebrate 150 years in this particular location. We have the resources. We have the students. We have the brain trust to do that. But what we lack is the resources to get it done and a focus policy to be able to develop those technologies in the area. Most of us are either in opportunity zones or near those. Most of the talk right now is on housing or commercial development in enterprise zones. But really, the biggest part of that commercial development should be the land resources that reside in those areas near those HBCU campuses to develop solar energy or renewable types of energies, whether it be solar or other renewable energy forms in those areas. Some campuses are saying, well, hey, we're going to do wind turbine driven farms, those kinds of things. But in the Southeast, where I know you grew up here in South Carolina, you know that the access to large expanses of land, strong days of unending sunshine results in a large amount of opportunity for us to be able to generate power, create our own grids, and sell some of that power back to make our communities more livable. But like I said, we don't have a strategy. We have been having conversations around the country with HBCUs and those communities about the opportunity zones and those opportunities for those campuses to develop those strategies. But what you're seeing are the people that have been involved in other industries, the housing industry, mixed use, those kinds of things, they are manipulating those opportunities because they already have plans in place. They were prepared before they released the opportunity zone list, and they have projects that they are targeting for those areas.
Well, Mr. Sally, I want you to put a plug in that, because I want our listening audience to be very clear of what you just said. Because, see, me living here in I'm in the belly of the beast, right here in Washington, D.C. I'm on Capitol Hill constantly. I'm in government agencies constantly looking for opportunities for our solar installation and development companies. And I'm working very, very, very closely with a number of projects. Now, I have a client who his family is based here in Washington, D.C., but his family hails from Chester, South Carolina. Well, very few people know the history of Chester. Black folk in Chester County. I mean,
right.
Black mayor, black city council. And we went down and looked at a project for this particular family. They own over 300 acres of land, and they're in the funeral home business. And they wanted to develop a 20-megawatt solar farm. Our thinking was to reach out to Benedict Voorhees, SC State Claflin, and do some type of workforce development training and maintenance opportunity for our students there who would be interested in this area to tie it into this. But the major problem we ran into, even though we found the financing from the developer, was the issue of who could, as you indicated, who has control over the from the generation to the uplink of this project. So when we looked after doing our due diligence and spoke with the cooperative that controlled the market area where this land was controlled, and we talked to the people in Colombia, we found out, as you said, we could identify off-takers, technology off-takers, and industrial hemp now is legal in all 50 states. We identified some couple of African-Americans who were fortunate enough to get a license to grow industrial hemp in South Carolina. So we were looking at how we could do a mixed-use concept with developing a processing facility on the land, build the 20-megawatt mm-hmm. solar farm, as well as how some of this energy could be used, because you had a main interstate coming near that property, could be used to build a major charging hub for our for cars going up and down the interstate. So we came up with the mixed-use concept. We worked on the preliminary a business plan, did an outline, met with people at SBCD here at Howard University. Make a long story short, then it came right down to what you indicated earlier. When we looked at the spread between what they were willing to offer us and what we could get, they're talking 3 to 4 cents. And when we did our preliminary assessment, cost out everything, labor, cleaning the land, we found out that this farm could generate $10 million annually in actual energy yield that could be sold if we could get anything close to the retail rate. But what they were offering us prohibited us from even moving forward. So if we can't get our people educated around how these things are impacting their lives when you got a situation like with the fiasco with the nuclear power plant down there and something down there and the billions of construction overruns, they've got to get this energy from somewhere. For our HBCUs and our black farmers not be able to take advantage of this, to me, it's unconscionable, but I don't see any other way around addressing these issues if our African-American solar installation and development companies aren't in the room at some of these conferences you're having to let people know that there are solutions to this, because there are billions of dollars in private sector funding coming out here. Matter of fact, of the president, outgoing president of Wells Fargo, spoke at the mayor's conference here back in January in Washington, D.C. of this year, and indicated that Wells Fargo, through their green initiative, had spent $5 billion in the last $5 billion in the last 5 years, and they're going to spend $20 billion in the next 10 years. And that's just one source of financing. So to me, we got to sort of make sure that our solar installation and development companies are represented in the room to bring in their input as to some of the solutions, because nobody's going to save us but us. And
that's correct.
I see the urgent need of what your organization doing, that there has to be a way that we can get this information into the arrows of our young people on these campuses, because they're the ones who are going to be affected by this new 5G technology, cybersecurity, all of these job opportunities tie right back into energy and utilities.
That's true. That's certainly true. And, you know, that's one of the things that we're trying to tie back to the campuses themselves, are opportunities for our young people. We went before the legislature here about a year ago, and surprisingly enough, when our president and myself and some of our senior faculty went over there and spoke to the legislature, it was on the same day that the South Carolina Solar Alliance was there. One of the things that was surprising, they were asking the Black Caucus here in South Carolina to assist them in approving an increase in that the reimbursement rate for selling power back. and they was, and one of the questions was asked by one of the legislators. He said, well, you know, in your particular company, he was talking to the president of the Solar Alliance. He said, in your particular company, he said, how many African Americans do you have? Now, this is a company that over a three-year period had gone from about 5 employees to 80. He said, we have 2 black employees, had asked one of his assistants, and he had to admit that those individuals were installers. And he referenced our president, who was sitting behind him in the audience. He said, well, you all need to see Dr. Artis, our president. She's got a campus full of young people who are studying to be engineers, business majors, accountants, all of those things. That, and you know, his first response was, oh, well, we can't find individuals. So getting folks in the industry, people of color, people that are sensitive to the needs of our community and can help develop solutions for our community, that's one strategy that we need to certainly tackle, because the people that control it, they don't want people that look like us working behind the scenes, putting projects, developing projects that can say, well, hey, this is a way to energy freedom. But, of course, the Solar Alliance, they're operating most of the solar farms here in South Carolina.
Well,
but
this is why, for our calling audience, they can dial 646-668-2948. You can join us by dialing 646-668-2948. But Mr. Sally, this is exactly why I wanted you on this show today, because I've been beating this drum till I bust the cover. About 6 times I had to order me some new sheepskins, because these are real initiatives that are in the church of what's happening now. Bernie Sanders, who is one of the main candidates, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know who's going to win this next election, but I know he has indicated, if he's elected, he's going to put $16 trillion in the Green Deal. And what I want our listening audience to be aware of, the fact of the matter is, regardless of who is elected, climate change is a real issue. If you don't know that climate change is real, today is October the 2nd, 2019. It's going to be 96 degrees here in Washington, D.C. Now, I don't know how much reality you need to know what's going to be fake news and what's going to be real news, but I know if you stick your head out the door, you think it's August here in Washington, D.C. today. So we don't have to question whether climate change is real. We know this, but we also know what is real is that electric vehicle infrastructure, renewable portfolio standard legislation is being passed in all 50 states. State of South Carolina has just passed a Freedom Act. State of New York just passed the 100 Renewable Portfolio Standard. The City of Washington, D.C. has passed the 100 Renewable Portfolio Standard Act. What our people aren't aware of, Mr. Sally, is that we are paying for these new policies, because what happened here in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to use Washington because it is a test tube, baby, and believe what happens here goes or affects everybody around the country. Mayor Bowser in 2016 signed the first renewable portfolio standard legislation for Washington, D.C. It had a 5% carve-out for solar energy. Now, very many of us realize that we have some of the most dynamic leadership in the country in our people running these utility companies. Ms. Donna Coop is in a Pepco here. She is a dynamic African-American woman. Mr. Banks, who is the vice president, is a dynamic African-American brother. I know both of them personally. They are graduates of Howard University, an HBCU. They are very, very cognizant of the needs of the black community. And what they said to me sitting in a meeting, Listen, Mr. Bethea, thank you for coming down to cover this, because I do cover a lot of these things. Listen, news media, they said, thank you for covering this. This is no more than a backdoor tax on our ratepayers. She said, look, we are Exelon. We are a nuclear power company. We own solar and wind farms, but we are basically a nuclear-based company. But we understand that if you're going to pass renewable portfolio standard legislation here in Washington, D.C., if you go towards 8567, where the African-American population has not been moved out yet, you're going to find out those who are homeowners are baby boomers. They're 55 years and older. Unless the mayor's going to put $50 to $90 million in roof repair, as I said, Mr. Sally, in rooftop repair to help fix those roofs on those homes, to initiate a program to say you're going to help 100,000 low and moderate income residents reduce their energy costs by 50% by year 2032, and use that as a standard where you put into place a green bank and you put $256 million in capitalization fees on your water, gas, and electric bills, Mr. Sally. When you pay your water, gas, and electric bill, you're helping capitalize a green bank at $256 million over the next 10 years. That's just one pool of money that sets over the Public Service Commission. Over on the other shot, because there was a shortfall of D.C.-based solar, D.C. ratepayers paid $15 million extra in the form of compliance fees. Well, Pepco wrote the check, and this is the point that Mrs. Cooper was making. She said, well, we can write the check, but our lawyers are at the table. This is serious business. Our lawyers are at the table, so we are able to pass these costs back on to our ratepayers in the form of compliance fees. Well, these compliance fees, when you're hitting people with something called, everybody's going to, if you keep living, it's called something called, one day it's called death and retirement. Well, one day you're going to be on something called fixed income called retirement. When you're on fixed income, that's what it means. So when you're talking to homeowners who are in their homes, but they got to decide between a $60 additional surcharge that's coming in on their electric, gas, or water bill because of the shortfall of D.C.-based solar. And in 2000, this was in 2000 for 2016. In 2017, those compliance fees jumped to $26.6 million. That was at a 5% carve-out. In 2017, what they call the extracts or the credits, the extracts took a hit. So all of your advocacy organization came in and go, because Washington, we don't have enough space, so we have the highest extracts values in the country outside of California. They're trading for almost $400 a kilowatt hour. So everybody in this city is pushed for this 100% renewable portfolio standard. Well, it got passed for 10% carve-out. That doubles these compliance fees. Also, these surcharges on the water, gas, and electric bills have also doubled, Mr. Sally. So I'm just saying these are things that are happening because, as you inelegantly stated, when people are making public policy, our politicians are making public policy, you got to understand whose interest is being served. And if we don't get up to speed with educating our communities, that we have to be more active and educated around how this energy game is affecting our communities, because this is serious, 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 serious money we're talking about. We're not talking about, we're talking about $1 billion. The solar and renewable energy industry, according to SEER report they put out in 2017, did $263 billion in this country and has not scratched the surface.
Wow.
So looking at the type of potential that our HBCUs have and where they're strategically located, our schools are gold mines sitting there. And I know this for a fact because I've sat down with funders, and the company told me we've got $300 million to put into development for large-scale solar plants, but they don't have people of color to go to our institutions and to talk to our people and to market this thing. And this thing has to be tied back in with our solar installation, development installation companies. Those are African-American-run companies because we don't have but a few, but they are well-connected. Believe me when I tell you that. So I want to sort of talk about and sort of change the topic and talk about what are some of the initiatives that some of the schools that are part of the collaboration have initiated, because as I look at, you have Benedict, Claflin, Coppin, Florida Memorial, Johnson C. Smith, Morgan, Norfolk, North Carolina A&T, Prairie View, Southern Tennessee State, Texas Southern, University of Maryland, Eastern Shore, and University of Virgin Islands. So could you sort of speak on some of the initiatives that some of the individual schools are doing right now?
Well, sure. I'd be happy to. You know, the grant that we received and the initiative that we developed with the Department of Energy was built around the project that started at Morgan State, which is their Solar Mile project, which was a project designed to serve 30 homes in and around the city of Baltimore by helping to install solar panels, do solar education, promote energy efficiency there. They actually outfitted, as I said, 30 homes in that area. They're trying to go after some additional monies to do a second phase of that, but that's what got us started. That was the impetus. At some of the other campuses, of course, Benedict College, we've been doing research on using solar power to promote charging stations, to remarket and rebrand, and we're one of the few campuses that we actually have a African-American veteran-owned solar installation, solar marketing firm. As a matter of fact, they're located across the hall from our office here, South Carolina.
Would you please put me in contact with them, because I need to be in contact with them ASAP. But no, excuse me, go right ahead.
Well, I certainly can do that. He was in here to see me yesterday, but our students worked with him last semester to help him develop a marketing plan, because I told him he's been on campuses from Tennessee to North Carolina to South Carolina, a lot of the HBCU campuses, trying to promote products and services that are going to make them more energy efficient and certainly more energy independent. I know at Prairie View, they've got a solar farm that they're just getting up and going. They want to do a demonstration project to show how your own generating your own solar power can free you or reduce your reliance on the power grid itself. In the Virgin Islands, they have a solar farm there also. I believe St. Augustine's project there in Raleigh was designed around wind power, using wind turbines to, of course, generate power themselves. Those are a couple of the smaller projects that are going on. Some of the others are energy efficiency, doing education, going into the community, taking students to go in the community, hold workshops, talk about solar policy, talk about renewable energy policy and those kinds of things, because, of course, we lack education in those areas. And just to illustrate our point, several years ago, before we got this initiative going, about 3 or 4 years ago, post-Katrina, we were in New Orleans. We were finishing up a workshop with probably about 30 HBCUs. We took a tour of New Orleans, and as we were riding through the Gentilia neighborhood and a couple others, I made a remark. I said, gosh, it's wonderful to see all of these houses with solar panels on them. lo and behold, and I knew there had to be something up with it. Of course, what we found out was most of the solar panels, and there were a lot of the homes that were outfitted with those wonderful little tract homes there in the community. We found out that they were leasing that equipment. So the only thing that they benefited from at most was a small reduction in their power bill. They were not eligible to get any of the tax credits that are attached to
the
installing that equipment.
The 30% ITC. Yeah, ITC. And the other part that are the those in, that energy that is not being used that with these smart meters that are able to record that amount of energy that's being generated by that PV system that's not being used by that household, turns that meter backwards. And the local utility there can track that credit, that they can give them a credit or send them a check. And this is what the whole thing is about. And with a lot of these programs, and I agree with you 200%, that those who served in the Obama administration who were aware of the large amount of federal funding that was coming down the pipeline left his administration, and a lot of them started organizations such as Groundswell. That's one that I know that's working around the country. You have Grid Alternatives and a lot of these different organizations. But what's been very, very disturbing to me is to listen to the conversations that I've had with African American solar installation development companies. Some are alumnus of the HBCUs that have struggled with trying to be able to get to with the decision makers to try to initiate programs. Now, I want to ask you this question while I've got you here. I sent you some information, and one of them was on a 5-year green sustainability program. Did you get that email?
I did. Is that the project that you all are doing in concert with Lemoyne Owen College?
Yeah, that's the project that Dr. Abrams, Dr. Abrams, is her company is Peer Consultants, and I've been working very, very closely with her. Dr. Abrams started here in Washington, D.C. in 1978 with three employees. She's now grown this firm to where she's hired over 200 African American engineers and architects. She has five companies nationally and two companies offices internationally. Well, she has five national companies and two international offices. But she was the first African American woman to receive a PhD in environmental engineering. And her thing is, as you will see, I hope you were able to open that up and look at it, is that what we are trying to do is come in with a 5-year plan, but not tell the institution what to do first. Extract the data, come up with a ways of where we have identified some funding sources to help these HBCUs, because a lot of our schools just don't have the trained personnel on board to do the energy audits. And these are things that I'm pleased, and I hope that y'all have looked at discussing how our HBCUs can open up maybe some of our classroom spaces on our HBCU campuses during the summer months and run some of these workforce development training programs in conjunction with some of our high schools, because we do have some green tech high schools. For example, the District of Columbia just invested $9 million in the D.C. Infrastructure Academy, but they only had 700 people to come into a brand new state of the art, but people don't know about it. So what I have been trying to do is connect the dots through this platform, Solar Now in the Future with its Economic Impact, and we've been working day and night trying to find a way to raise the money so we can syndicate this particular show with our HBCUs, because our HBCU radio stations are all public service stations. What does PBS public service stations mean? They broke. They need some money. So what are the things? That's what I say when I'm speaking to that is that commercial licensing of commercial licensing for our stations, other than Howard University, maybe a couple of more that have commercial license, but most of our HBCU radio stations are public NPR stations. So they just
That's
don't
right.
have the money. So for programming, you got to go out and you got to get sponsors, and that's been one of the biggest challenges is to be able to provide this valuable information, Mr. Sally, that you provide over this platform to reach the ear hole of our young people because they need to know about the various internships. And I do a segment, which I'll be doing after we close out this interview on the weekly solar renewable energy opportunities here in the DMV market area, and they're all over the country. People, all they have to do is go to Indeed or ZipRecruiter, put in solar energy, put in the zip code, and all of those opportunities that are in that marketplace will appear to you. But most of our people will not get those opportunities if we don't have the workforce development training programs and to get them up to speed with their certifications and where they can get some experience working on with hands-on experience. And I think that this initiative through your groups is you're the point of the spear.
Well, we're certainly trying to do what we can to help push this effort forward. But the work that you're doing there, Mr. Bethay, you know, really makes ours a lot easier because you're an advocate. You're certainly knowledgeable about many of the challenges in the industry, and we need to have that collective voice. You know, I'm going to suggest to our executive director, Ron Butler, that we convene another meeting. Right after the first of the year, we want to invite you, and we want to refine our strategy because, as I said, we're going back to the JPB Foundation to try to expand this initiative. We're hoping to ask them for over $1 million to fund a larger initiative, and they have said that they're interested. We want to go back and spend some time with the Department of Energy, even though we've got an uphill challenge with the current administration. I do think that there's smaller pockets of money that could be used to push the development of renewable energies in the communities that we're serving and try to find ways to address some of the restrictions that are preventing us from setting up our own grids, setting up our own solar farms and those kinds of things. That's where we have to go, and we have to do that very quickly because the other folks already have their game plan. They're already working.
Mr. Sally, that is why I was so happy when you accepted my invitation to come on this show. I hope our listening audience fully are getting the impact of your words because you are speaking based on what you are doing every day and you see every day. And if our institutions don't have a game plan, our communities don't have a chance.
Well, that's certainly true. That's certainly true. And that's why we got to spend a lot of time educating them. And I think they're interested because they see that we see it as an emerging technology. It's already here. It's already being implemented. We're just not a full partner in that process. But those solutions need to come from these campuses, from our young people, and from our communities. And we need to be leading that effort.
Well, one of the things I want to share with you, I did send you a couple of links, and I know you probably didn't have a chance to look at all that stuff, but I sent you a link on Duke Renewable Program allows large customers to negotiate directly with suppliers. I thought this was quite interesting Green Source Advantage GSA programs. North Carolina, which will allow large customers to negotiate directly with renewable energy suppliers on price terms. These 10 terms include purchase of the renewable energy certificates, extracts from generation facilities, and length of contract terms. Participating customers can bear the entire cost, which Duke officials said is not subsidized in any way. 350 megawatts of capacity currently is set aside for the University of North Carolina system, university system. And that is where I want to put a plug in it. Now, I know A&T is a part of that. I know Winston-Salem State is a part of it. But the rest of our schools in the state, they're private, aren't they?
Yes, they are. In North Carolina, there are, I think, the majority of HBCUs are a part of the system. Elizabeth City State is a part of the system, and they've got huge resources out there in that part of the state themselves.
Well, see, I'm glad you brought up Elizabeth City, because I'm going to give you a dirty little secret. George Washington University, George Washington University Hospital, and American University partnered with a power purchase agreement with Duke Energy. They built a 20-megawatt solar farm near Elizabeth City, which they've been running for the last 3 years, transmitting the energy back to Washington, D.C. to offset the energy costs. Georgetown University has purchased 300 acres of land. They're building a 30-megawatt farm in Charles County, Maryland, and it will be saving them half of their energy costs annually, which Georgetown University spends $32 million a year for energy. So
wow.
I agree that Elizabeth City State got a lot of university, because there's a tremendous amount of land there in that area. And because the state of North Carolina has a 35% ITC, with the federal 30%, anyone who's built a large-scale power plant, solar farm system in the state of North Carolina can take advantage of a 65% ITC. That is why you have billions of dollars that have gone into North Carolina, and North Carolina is one of the leading states in the United States of America in building large-scale power plants. Goose Creek, which is based out of Charlotte, North Carolina, they are the largest developer of large-scale power plants in the United States of America. All of these opportunities are there. My question is, how do we get, because there are not a lot of our players, African-American solar installation and development companies, to come to the table with your group when you have your next meet and bring what they have to the table, because this train should have left 8 years ago for us, but I don't know whether we understood that we needed to get to the train station, but we are in one hell of a catch up mode in terms of running behind this train, but we can catch this train because we're still paying for that train to be on the tracks. And this is one of the things that I'm clearly have not heard. I've heard everybody talk about climate change. I've heard everybody's talking about all these political issues, but nobody's talking about the economic impacts of this renewable energy impact on our communities. And everybody tells us how we're disproportionately affected by the impacts of climate change. We know this. We get this. But we want to be able to be on the economic development side and for us to be able to take and teach our young people how to start businesses and get a part of this niche. I just posted on my website that Georgia just opened up the largest solar builder of solar panels in the United States just opened up in the state of Georgia. There should have been no way that that plant opened up and not been talking to our HBCUs about developing some type of internships and collaborations with some of our HBCUs with Fort Valley State and Auburn and those schools sitting down there. They got the land.
That's right. That's right. And they have the brain trust. I mean, you've got Savannah State there in Georgia. You've got Albany State. You've got Atlanta University. Morehouse has an engineering school that's associated with Georgia Tech. I mean, they have the people there that could be at the forefront of any development of renewable energy there in that state, for sure.
Well, this is why I wanted you on. I had a young man who's based out of Atlanta, Georgia. He started an electric vehicle advocacy and educational organization to try to get our community up to speed on electric vehicles. And he was talking about what had taken place in the state of Georgia. And little did many people know that when Tesla came out with a promotion several years back, it was $1,000 promotion, that Georgia jumped number two in the nation for orders for electric vehicles. My brother-in-law, who went to Howard's, was married to my wife's sister, and she's an attorney, and they live on Stone Mountain. And Orlando, I asked Orlando, I said, Orlando, the white folks didn't say nothing. He said, look, I bought me a Leaf. He's an engineer. He said, I bought me a Leaf. He said, I did the math, right? It just made sense. He said, but what happened in the state of Georgia, after the lobbyists, who I call them the gunslingers, got wind that Georgia had jumped number two with electric vehicle orders behind the state of California, they went into Athens, Georgia, with the suitcases ablazing. He said they bought everything down. They bought everything that wasn't nailed down, and they took the 5,000 because they had a 5,000. The state of Georgia had a 5,000 state federal tax credit if you bought an electric vehicle, with the $7,500 federal tax credit. People in Georgia was getting $12,500 off the price of a new electric vehicle. He said, not only did they repeal the $5,000 state federal tax credit, he said they put a $250 tax credit on your tax for owning an electric vehicle, whether it was new or used.
Wow.
I said, Orlando, I said, the white folks didn't say nothing. He said, they saying something now. He said, but I don't think they really understood it because they just didn't pay attention to it. He said, but this is a serious piece down here in the Atlanta market area because everything is so, you know how Atlanta, everything's out. So in the counties. And he said, well, people are buying these electric vehicles, and we are put in a position where you have to be able to put a plug in at your home because of how the politics goes right back to public policy with Tesla, where if you get on certain routes, they only had charging stations where the plug-ins for the electric vehicles would fit Tesla vehicles. But they got all that stuff worked out. But the long and short of this, these are the type of opportunities that I've come to notice and learn because I've got four clients around the country that I've been working with that has land. Two of them are families and people are well off who wanted to develop large-scale solar farms, and one of them had an interstate running right through their property. So when we began to look at the opportunities for our HBCUs, because as you indicated, our HBCUs are our brain trust. we've got to find a way to bring together the solar, the African-American solar installation, development, and design companies in the room and say, hey, let's put it on the table. What are you working on? What are you working on? And how can we help each other? Because if we don't do this, we're in a world of trouble. And I know this to be a fact. And we've got to get around a lot of the personalities in this whole nine yards, because I won't call the name of the institutions, but I've been working with several of them here. And we found the money. We put everything in place, but until those decision makers decide they're going to come together, man, it's not going anywhere. So this is how things are happening. I want to thank you, Mr. Sally, from taking time from your very, very, very busy schedule, but I want to get you back on this show on a consistent basis with some of the institutions that are members of the collaboration group, where we can actually talk to those schools and those individuals at those institutions that are behind these initiatives with our young people that are part of those initiatives.
Well, that's certainly doable. We'll make that happen. We would love to have that. Our members are really the lead on anything that we do. We can get those project directors on, and they can talk directly about what they're doing and how they can assist their communities, or how their communities can get involved on those campuses, because it is a collaboration. But we welcome the opportunity, Mr. Buffet, and thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Sally, because like I said, I know how busy you are. I call, but I was determined I was going to make this interview happen, and I'm glad I was able to keep up to how I was able to get you, because you've been a wealth of knowledge and information for our listening audience, and I want to thank you, Mr. Butler, Mrs. Campbell, for spearheading this thing, because I know a lot of work went in to trying to get our folks to move. And I'll just say it like that and leave it like that.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for having us. And we're going to be in touch with you, because we're looking forward to getting your voice involved with the coalition to help move this industry forward. But thank you.
Yeah, well, I just want to have you to do one thing for me. If you could give Dr. Abrams, I think I sent you her contact information. If you could give her a call, I would greatly appreciate that, because she asked me. I said, well, I'm going to have the gentleman on my show, and we'll be talking about some things. So I once again, thank you for doing what you do, and you won't be a stranger to this platform, Solar Now in the Future, with its economic impact on Black America.
Well, we're looking forward to it, and I appreciate it. And once again, you're a part of what we're doing, and we're going to make sure that that happens. But thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. You have a blessed day.
All right. You do the same.
Well, that was Mr. Larry Sally with the HBCU Development Collaboration Group, and we were pleased to be able to get him on today. We're going to take a pause for the calls, and we'll be right back on the other side, and we're going to look at some other topics in the next segment of our show, and we'll be right back here on Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact.
Song worth singing, I can too sing it. Life is a song worth singing, why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand, use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
song worth singing. I can tell. Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.
Welcome, welcome back to the Airways of Soul and Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And I hope you enjoyed the first segment of our show. We saw the program back for 30 minutes, and we went over an hour because of the information that Mr. Larry Sally, who is the chairman of the board for the HBCU Community Development Corporation, and they have launched a green initiative, and we have been working very, very tirelessly with our HBCUs to get them to build large-scale solar farms to offset the energy costs, also to serve as another way to become workforce development training magnets for our young people in the communities that they're located in, because you don't have to spend 4 years at a college or university to get a six-month certification to become an electrician, to become a PV installer, to become an energy auditor. These are certifications that one can get and not spend that type of time, to become a home inspector. See, you can't sell a property without a home inspection done on it. Okay? These are very, very important certifications. And once you get them and you get your time in and you know what you're doing, you can do this any place in the world. Okay? And these are things that we need to be emphasizing with our young people who are getting a college degree, because you don't always come out of school and get an opportunity to get employment in the area where you were trained. But if you have a certification as an electrician, you can go to work anywhere. You know what you're doing. Once you have the certification as a energy auditor, you can find opportunities in any municipality in this country because we need them. So these are the things that we try to speak to and to give our young people some idea, hey, there are options out here other than just thinking you got to go to a four-year degree. A four-year college is fine. I don't have a problem with that. I'm saying our four-year college has got to do a little more. We got to do both. We don't have a choice. But anyway, if you've been listening to us on this platform, you know that this show is brought to you by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, which is a blueprint for economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American solar installation and development companies to address the high effects of energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities. to utilize black-owned farmlands, HBCU campuses, to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the unemployment and underemployment of our young African-American men and women locally and nationally. Also to educate the black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education in black communities through black talk radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on black America is also brought to you by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSF LF HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative, which you're listening to over the World Wide Web, over from your nation's capital, over Blog Talk Radio, which also streaming over iTunes, Twitter, Link, and Facebook. So you'll be able to follow this show on a weekly basis. It's also bought by on any of those platforms. All right, now we know that the little boy said it's always something that's going on. Nothing is standing in the way of energy storage explosion growth. This is published in a September the 16th, 2019 online electronic magazine called Utility Drive. And the author is H.J. Mayer. Through the growth of global energy storage markets is creating one of the high lines after another as analysis after analysis predicts new heights of investment and deployments and growth in the lithium battery industry. And these are market areas for growth and opportunities that our young people need to be looking into, and our HBCUs need to be doing research and development. Now, I should have stayed more on some of these technical areas. That's why you want to always outline your talking points. But I didn't do that today because we were just interested that we would be able to get this interview done, hit on the points that I needed to hit on with this particular show, and we'll bring Mr. Larry Sally back on, and we'll have some highlighted points. But this battery storage thing is growing. Issued a recent order. The Massachusetts Department of Utilities issued an urgent order to allow utilities companies to pay commercial property owners if they agree to rely upon their energy storage systems during peak events. The owners were ordered was a landmark state regulation for energy storage space, according to her. In other words, they need space right now just to put these lithium batteries for storage, because they got to have this energy somewhere where they can do what? When they need it, they can bring it online. Federal Regulatory Commission Order 81-841 was issued in February 2018 that directs independent systems of operators of regional transmission organizations to establish rules and regulations to open up their wholesale energy capacity and capacity auxiliary services market to energy storage resources. Okay? These are very, very important things in the international landscape. I'm just going through and looking at highlighting some of the various articles that we have under our news and events tab. This was the lead article. A Trump tariff boost, Georgia solar manufacturing plant will be the North America's largest. Now, this is an article that you'll be able to find, once again, by logging on to PositiveChangePC.com, click on our News and Events tab, scroll down. This is an article that was published on September the 24th, 2019 in Utility Dive. A global power solar plant manufacturer on Friday opened the largest solar manufacturing plant in the Western Hemisphere, citing the Trump administration's imports tariffs as is critical to its decision to build. The plant is located in Georgia and will produce 12,000 solar panels a day, along with 1.7 gigawatts of molecule capacity annually, according to the manufacturing. Now, this article, you'll be able to find this on this new manufacturer based in Georgia. Or under our news and events tab, you can scroll down further. You'll see CS 10-year roadmap for U.S. solar, what you need to know. PG&E note holders propose injecting $29.2 billion in a utility to exchange for a majority stake. It's got to be some money when people want to invest $29.2 billion for a utility that's filed Chapter 11. So you want to know where the billionaires play? This is where they play, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? Now, California proposes IOU collect $900 million annually for wildfire fund, with one major hurdle for the PG&E. Now, you'll find that this was offered by Robert Walton. You'll find that under our news and events tab here on this platform, Solar Now and the Future with its Economic Impact on Black America. Well, we want to apologize to our listening audience because we didn't do our weekly DMV workplace opportunity session here on the show today, but we'll be bringing that to you in future episodes in the future, because my interview with Mr. Larry Sally went much longer than I had planned, but I'm glad I did, because we were able to talk about a litany of other issues that needed to be discussed. So, you know, those who join us on a regular basis, you know, we hope that we brought you news that you can definitely use. And until next week, we say go in peace. And thank you for joining us for another episode, exciting episode of Solar Now and the Future with its Economic Impact on Black America. And until next week.
Song worth singing,
I can too.
Sing it. Life is a song worth singing,
why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand,
use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan,
change it.
Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.
I got you.
Sing it.